content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler, the Washington Post, and AAA Go Magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we undertake what you might call some quirky traveling. First up is Allie Gammon's article, Going the Distance, and it's found in the Obsessions column under the title Hiking in the 2018 October-November issue of National Geographic Traveler. Ms. Gammon is a backpacker, writer, and illustrator with more than 6,500 trail miles. In fact, she and her husband are currently hiking the 3,100-mile Continental Divide, a trip that I suspect we will feature in a future episode of Armchair Traveler. Returning to today, however, let's let Allie explain how, for 50 years, the National Scenic Trail System has forged memories foot by foot. While through hiking the entire Appalachian National Scenic Trail, I walked some 5 million steps. On the Pacific Crest National Scenic Trail, 6 million. My current trek, the Continental Divide National Scenic Trail, will require just about 7 million. But for each, one of the best steps was the very first. As I took that initial stride from the southern terminus of each one of those trails, Springer Mountain, Georgia, Campo, California, and Crazy Cook Monument, New Mexico, respectively, the anxiety of planning an endless checklist evaporated. All that remained was the rush of possibility. With thousands of miles before me and my husband beside me, I could feel that familiar thrill shivering up my spine. The trail works its magic. Footsteps transform dots on a map and notes in a guidebook into real places. The swimming hole, the campfire under the full moon, the aspen grove. And once passed, those dots and notes are further transfigured into cherished memories. Hikers are also transformed and christened anew with the adoption of a trail name. Early on in the Appalachian Trail, I decided to be Knock on Wood due to my knee-jerk reaction when others made predictions about the adventures that we would have. To my greenhorn self, bold predictions seemed to tempt fate. Though I originally took on my name as a joke about my fears, I now see it as more of a promise to appreciate each day on trail. Against the ponderous timelines of the lands we walk, our human lives seem brief and insubstantial. Each moment on trail is a gift. I dreamed of the Sierra Nevada Mountains long before I reached them along the Pacific Crest Trail in 2017. The previous 700 miles of the trail had been dry, so it had been hard to envision the high snow and roaring rivers of the mountain passes, their danger, and their beauty. I knew the land would be harsh, stark, pure. I knew that I would feel fear as we crested the heights. But I did not know, not in my heart or bones, how my knees would tremble when I faced a steep, 100-yard-long glissade down Sonora Pass. Night was falling fast as my husband, our friends, and I reached the final leg of the pass. The top of the snow was slushy from the day's heat, and I felt as if I were looking through a fisheye lens as I struggled dizzily onto the steep snowfield. Our friend Kickstep gamely went first, gracefully plunging down the pass, shrinking to ant size in the gathering dusk. Flowers was next, then my husband, called Honey Buns, finally me. I sat in the slush, quivering as the sky turned violet above me. My friends below shouted encouragement. The chute of snow, carved by fellow hikers, seemed endless. I nudged myself forward with my heels, and then gravity took over. Using my ice axe to break and emitting a shrill wail the whole way, I skidded and shrieked to the bottom, breathless and exhilarated. I staggered to my feet and watched the stars coming out, marveling at the wonders around me and in me. I believe we leave behind some part of ourselves on the paths we walk. When I first started on the Appalachian Trail, I was hoping to follow in the footsteps of my cousin Jen, 11 years my senior, who had thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail more than a decade before. A globe-warming hippie with a tiny pack and a zest for silly puns, Jen has always inspired me to seek adventure. On days when rain pelted down, I imagined Jen undaunted braving the same storm. In her favorite places, such as Bob People's quirky woodland hostel, Kinkora, I felt a new connection between us. I also felt a kinship with those unknown people who had preceded me. I tried to imagine the individuals, their hopes, their stubbed toes, their faces warmed in the sun. Where did their journeys take them? On the Continental Divide Trail in Colorado, Rollins Pass is covered in rock blinds from which herd animals were once ambushed. They were in use for millennia. I stood among the stones, the wind chilling my bones, and tried to reach back through time to feel something of the ancient hunters who had gathered there. On the Pacific Crest Trail in California, it was a blisteringly hot afternoon as I staggered up Donner Pass. I loosened my hip belt and fought down my nausea. At the ski restaurant we'd stopped at earlier, my husband and I had shoveled down plates of nachos, then added most of a pie and a couple of beers to boot. Now I had to sit and rest, and all I could think of was how different my experience was from that of the ill-fated Donner Party, a group of pioneers who had come more than a century and a half before. I also imagine those who would follow. Who will walk these lands a day or a century from now? The National Scenic Trail System celebrates its 50th birthday this year. Congress passed the 1968 Act partly to conserve the Appalachian Pacific Crest Trails. Now the network of government-protected recreational paths, numbers 11, including the Natchez Trace Trail, the Florida Trail, and the Potomac Heritage Trail, and encompasses some 18,000 miles. Every year, thousands of people hike, bike, and horseback ride through rocky steeps and flat grasslands. In another 50 years, may our public lands be just as cherished, our wilderness endearingly preserved. May we still find that transformative magic. Wow. Well, included with Allie Gammon's article is a brief day trips on scenic trails list, and we'll step through this fairly quickly here. It's the Appalachian Trail, Nuclear Lake, New York, an easy day hike convenient to New York City. The clear and tree-lined Nuclear Lake makes for a refreshing place to wait on a hot day. Then there's the Continental Divide Trail, Jordan, Hot Springs, New Mexico. Near the Gila Cliff Dwelling National Monument, take the Little Bear Canyon Trail to the Gila River alternate trail. After exiting a high slot canyon, the trail meanders among sheer rock walls in the cool Gila River. Jordan Hot Springs is a very comfortable 94 degrees Fahrenheit tucked among the trees. And finally, we have the Pacific Crest Trail, Lake Aloha, California. Convenient to South Lake Tahoe, shallow Lake Aloha is mirror-like. The sparse trees, dark surrounding hills, and wildflowers feel alpine. The nearby town of Echo Lake has a shuttle boat that you can take for part of the hike. So some ideas there if you're interested in some unusual hiking, right? Well, hiking and walking are certainly among the oldest and perhaps most common forms of traveling, but there's another increasingly popular method of standing on your own two feet and then letting your arms propel you. Now, this is called paddleboarding. Freelance writer Melanie D.G. Kaplan recently saw her hometown of Washington, D.C. in a new light. Her article, Rediscovering Washington, D.C. on a Stand-Up Paddleboard, appears in the April 5th, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. Washington is home. As a child, I picnicked along the C&O Canal and biked through Rock Creek Park to the zoo. I counted the stairs up the Washington Monument, climbed the Awakening statue when it was at Haynes Point, and performed with a dance troupe at the Kennedy Center. As a young adult, I put down roots on Capitol Hill and fell in love with my home city. But every few months, I'd find myself falling into predictable rhythms and routines, and I would long for the open road. I'd hop in my car and drive to, say, California, stopping in small towns, exploring by bike, and meeting strangers. I came to understand that adventure fuels me. I need to keep pursuing new things, or I wilt. So when a kayaking friend surprised me with a pink stand-up paddleboard called an SUP nearly a decade ago, knowing that I had SUP'd once and loved it, I ended my embargo on the color pink imposed after an excessively pink childhood and embraced the challenge of learning a new sport. Summer weekend mornings, my eyelids would pop open before daybreak, and I'd pull up a weather website to make sure it wasn't too windy. Driving on empty roads with the board strapped to my car, I would race the sun, wanting to hit the water first. Initially, I paddled out of Columbia Island Marina next to the Pentagon, heading into the Potomac. I'd bend my knees, steady my board, and look up to see the Washington Monument across the river behind a grove of trees. My city! I loved it even more from the water. Before long, I began putting in at different spots along the Potomac and Anacostia Rivers. I learned my way around the urban waterways like I had Washington's freeways. Some days, I'd paddle under Arlington Memorial Bridge, past the Kennedy Center and Theodore Roosevelt Island, and toward the Georgetown waterfront. Other days, I'd reach the Woodrow Wilson Memorial Bridge and cruise over to the giant spinning wheel at National Harbor. Still others, I'd navigate past RFK Stadium and toward the National Arboretum and Kenilworth Park and Aquatic Gardens. No matter where I paddled, I was free from quotidian stress. Occasionally, I'd encounter traffic, which meant yielding to a procession of ducklings. Rush hour meant sharing the water with collegiate rowers and the Army Corps of Engineers debris vessel that picks up logs and branches. As my confidence on the board grew, I tested myself in new ways, shifting the position of my feet or sprinting to a buoy. Soon I could surf little waves after a motorboat buzzed by, and I could predict which direction planes would land at Reagan National Airport based on the wind. Some days I found myself parallel to the runway, directly under the flight path. Seconds before landing, a jet's headlights would point at me, and as the giant bird passed overhead, its might would rumble through my body and ripple the water. My paddleboard, 10 feet long, agile and quiet, became the perfect vehicle for seeing Washington. I appreciated the skyline and monuments as well as views further inland, such as Washington National Cathedral in Northwest and the George Washington Masonic National Memorial in Alexandria. But even better, the board offered a backstage pass to nooks, crannies, and points of view that few tourists would ever see. I paddled by the historic Seafarers Yacht Club, cruised by the missile battery atop the Navy Yard parking garage, steered around the back side of the Titanic Memorial in Southwest, and explored the spot where Rock Creek empties into the Potomac just north of the Watergate. Great blue herons fished on the banks, and bugs danced on the water's surface. At times, I felt like a voyeur, watching couples stroll along the Mount Vernon Trail and sailors tidy their boats. Bases heavily guarded on land gave the impression of being easily accessible by water. I paddled past the historic hangars at Joint Base Anacostia Bowling and up to the National War College at the confluence of the Anacostia and Potomac. As I paddled along the water boarding Fort Leslie J. McNair, I glided close enough to the light poles to see security cameras, close enough to a residence to see a boy blowing bubbles in his backyard. As I've paddled, the city has changed. From the Anacostia west of the Navy Yard, I watched glass apartment buildings and a soccer stadium rise from the ground. From the Washington Channel, I saw the wharf materialize so quickly, so utterly changing the waterfront, that I scarcely remember the location of Phillips, where my grandparents took my family for special dinners. As these new developments began humming with activity, the rivers did, too. On pleasant days, I'd paddle past tour boats, dinner cruises, water taxis, dragon boats, canoes, and kayaks. Last July, I heard about a new dock at East Potomac Park. I drove there early one morning and launched my board into the Washington Channel. As I paddled north, the sun rose, slipping between buildings at the wharf-like light through a pinhole camera. At the far end of the channel, I saw a squat stone archway, and I crouched on my paddleboard to fit underneath. Gliding forward in a small tunnel, resting on my shins, I battled away cobwebs with my paddle. The air was typical for July, muggy and windless, but a chill ran through my body. Alone in the dark cavity, unsure whether I'd venture into a forbidden area, I was at once fearful and curious. I continued through the arch and found myself under a low bridge. A short fence stopped me. Beyond it, the view opened up dreamlike. As my board bobbed in the water, I looked out to see the tidal basin I've known my whole life. But the perspective was new, disorienting, thrilling. The low sun ignited the water in front of me. My heart raced, and I couldn't stop smiling. I paddled back down the channel feeling euphoric about my discovery, a vantage point that before that day would have seemed inconceivable. Later that week, I tried to return with a camera, but when I approached the arches, I found the openings blocked. I turned back, deflated and puzzled. Had I been caught in lawfully paddling through the arches? Has someone boarded them up? Driving out of the park, I stopped at the National Park Service headquarters to find out. The arches weren't boarded up, a ranger told me. These were the gates that open and close with the tides. Her words echoed in my mind. You know, the tidal basin? Of course, the tidal basin. During all my years in Washington, I'd never considered how the basin functioned. And now, I had unknowingly paddled through its back doors. Several times last summer, I returned to the arches and found the gates closed. I felt as though I'd seen the Loch Ness Monster. Without a picture of the view, would anyone believe me? I vowed to try again in the spring. In March, I called the Army Corps, which built the tidal basin and gates starting in the 1880s, to flush debris out of what was once a mosquito-infested pool and a dumping ground for sewage. I learned that inlet gates on the Potomac open to let water into the tidal basin. As the tide ebbs, the gates close, and the outlet gates open to flush water and sediment down the channel into the Anacostia. Then a new tidal cycle begins. The magic is that twice a day, as the tide changes, the gates open and close on their own. 2 weeks ago, on a warm afternoon, I studied the tidal charts and headed out, attempting again to time my paddle with the opening of the outlet gates. Sun warmed my shoulders as I passed the fish market and a tree packed with black-crowned night herons. But then I saw the closed gates and pulled my paddle out of the water disappointed. The next day, I went at a different time with the same results. I considered surrendering. The third day, it was 40 degrees. I carried my board to the dock late in the day, wearing a wetsuit, neoprene booties, and a knit hat. I half expected someone to tell me I couldn't go out because it was too dangerous, too cold, too windy, too close to sunset. But the freedom that comes with being on the water means freedom to go out, even when conditions are dicey. Across from the docks, flags at the Capitol Yacht Club stuck straight out like cookie sheets. I was racing against the sinking sun. Powering up the channel, I found myself in the middle of rush hour, yet alone. I paddled under the Interstate 395 bridge, crammed with cars, and looked ahead to the next bridge, where freight trains carrying UPS and Tropicana containers moved in opposite directions. A plane descended, a helicopter whirred. From a distance, I could see a golden light shining through the small archways. The gates were open. I paddled hard against the wind, approaching one of the arches. Then I ducked on my board and cruised through the steel frame. Gates, which I now looked at with awe. Holding my camera, I glided to the spot I'd been thinking about since last summer, the small pool of water between the gates and the short fence that abuts the tidal basin. I looked out to the Thomas Jefferson Memorial and Washington Monument, and my heart sang. Around the water, cherry blossoms were starting to open. The sun dipped below a line of trees. My feet ached with cold, and I knew the tide was about to change. If the gates closed, I'd be stuck there for 12 hours. I paddled a half mile back to the dock, the wind now behind me. Bright blue and pink lights decorated the I-95 bridge reflected on the water. Mallards bobbed, and boats, still dressed in their winter white shrink wrap, creaked in the marina. At the wharf, the Anthem marquee glowed. A gas-powered fire pit flickered at the end of the new pier. The wind knocked my board into the dock, and I stepped off the water, wasting little time before I was in the car, heat blasting. After surviving what felt like a perilous expedition, feeling triumphant, I drove out of East Potomac Park with my board on the roof, merging with traffic on Main Avenue Southwest, and I headed home. And by the way, Kaplan is a freelance writer, and she has a website. It's MelanieDGKaplan.com, and it's DG and then K-A-P-L-A-N, MelanieKaplan.com, if you want to follow some of her traveling adventures. She's quite an interesting person. We've had several of her articles over the years on Armchair Traveler. And if you'd like to see Washington, D.C. via waterway, there are some boating in D.C. tips Melanie has provided for us. Here we go. And here's some information you can find. It's called BoatingNDC.com. You can go online again to BoatingNDC.com. This outfitter offers rentals at the following boathouses. Some locations offer daytime and twilight kayak and paddleboard tours of the monuments, all rentals or weather permitting. Stand-up paddleboard rentals are $22 per hour at all boathouses below that offer it, not including tax. Minimum rental time is 1 hour, and rates are prorated, every 10 minutes after 1 hour. The all-day rental rate is four times the hourly rate. And here are these boathouses she's referring to in her article. Ball House Boat Park, this is at Potomac Avenue and First Street Southeast, outside Nats Park on the Anacostia. Kayak and canoe rentals available May 24th. Then there's the Columbia Island Marina, George Washington Memorial Parkway in Arlington. Next to the Pentagon and Lady Bird Johnson Park on the Boundary Channel, kayak and paddleboard rentals available as of May 1st. Then we have the Fletcher's Boathouse at 4940 Canal Road, Northwest. Access to both the Potomac and C&O Canal. Kayak, canoe, rowboat, and paddleboard rentals currently available, and that's as of April 2019. Stand-up paddleboard rentals starting early May. Now we have the Keys Bridge Boathouse, located at 3500 Water Street Northwest. You paddle from the Potomac from the Georgetown waterfront. Kayak, canoe, and paddleboard rentals start April 13th, or they're already underway. Then we have the National Harbor, 165 Waterfront Street, Oxon Hill, Maryland, and that's spelled O-X-O-N. Across from the Alexandria and next to the Wilson Bridge, Swan Pedal Boats, Kayak, and paddleboard rental starting May 4th. And then we have the Thompson Boat Center at 2900 Virginia Avenue Northwest. Now, this is across from the Watergate on the Potomac. Your kayak, canoe, rowboat, paddleboard, and hydro bike rental started April 15th. So if you paid your taxes, you can go out on the water. Then there's Tidal Basin, 1501 Main Avenue Southwest. Pedal boats and swan boat rentals are currently available. The Washington Sailing Marina at 1 Marina Drive, Alexandria, just south of National Airport on the Potomac. Kayak and paddleboard rentals available as of May 1st. The Wharf Boathouse at 700 Water Street Southwest. You paddle along the Washington Channel and along Haynes Point, and kayaks and paddleboard rentals are available as of April 26th. And if you'd like a full list of boathouses, Ms. Kaplan suggests you check out WashingtonPost.com/travel. That's WashingtonPost.com/travel. BEAUFORT. The name is spelled, but the same, but pronounced differently, depending on whether you are in North or South Carolina. Writers Seeley and Lynn Selden's article, Battling Beauforts or Beauforts, explains how these two coastal communities share more than a name. And their article is from the March-April 2019 issue of AAA Go magazine. We say Beaufort, they say Beaufort, but however you pronounce it, we're talking about two top coastal Carolina towns named after English politician Henry Somerset. Duke of Beaufort, those charming and historic county seats have much more in common than their names, and learning the tale of two towns is as simple as hitting the road. I will default to Beaufort sometimes because we are in North Carolina, after all. But we check out first Beaufort, South Carolina. Located on Port Royal Island in the heart of the Sea Islands that stretch from Jacksonville to Charleston, Beaufort, pronounced Beaufort, is the county seat of Beaufort County and is known for its lush low country landscape, antebellum architecture, and genteel southern hospitality. The adopted hometown of beloved writer Pat Conroy and the setting of classic films including The Big Chill, Forrest Gump, and The Prince of Tides. Beaufort is rich in history, military might, and often bestowed with top small town accolades. The waterfront is one of Beaufort's top attractions. With its downtown set squarely along the Beaufort River, the Henry C. Chambers Waterfront Park is the heartbeat of the community. Overlooking the Beaufort Marina, the park features a well-landscaped green space, communal swings, playgrounds, and a pavilion stage for live performances. It backs up to the three-block-long downtown shopping and dining district. The park is also home to many festivals. Since 1956, Beaufort has celebrated the importance of its waterways with a massive 10-day festival each summer, the Beaufort Water Festival, featuring regattas, fishing tournaments, raft racing, water skiing, air shows, arts and crafts, concerts, food and fireworks. The festival is a summer highlight. Other area attractions, the story of the first European colonial capital in Santa Elena History Center, the history of the original Gullah community at the Penn Center on nearby St. Helena Island, and nearby Hunting Island State Park, among others. Many of these attractions are included on several walking and van tours offered by Beaufort Tours. And as far as places to stay, quintessential southern inns and bed and breakfast are found throughout the historic district, from intimate rooms and historic mansions like Anchorage 1770 and the Cuthbert House Inn to more sprawling accommodations and cottages at the Red House Inn and the Beaufort Inn. There are many ways to enjoy true Southern hospitality. Now we return to Beaufort, and located 350 miles northeast, Beaufort, North Carolina, pronounced Beaufort, is located along the Beaufort Inlet, a channel that leads to the Atlantic Ocean, part of the Crystal Coast. Beaufort is North Carolina's third oldest city and the county seat of Carteret County. Much of Beaufort's attractions also center around water. The North Carolina Maritime Museum on Front Street features exhibits about Beaufort's maritime history, the seafood industry, life-saving stations, lighthouses, and watercraft. Perhaps its most popular exhibit is Blackbeard and Queen Anne's Revenge, which illuminates the life of the early 18th century swashbuckler. Enjoy a ferry ride to see wild horses on Rachel Carson Reserve or Shackelford Banks. Climb the lighthouse at Cape Lookout National Seashore or dive the shipwrecks of the Graveyard of the Atlantic. Other options? Discovering Beaufort's colonial past at the Beaufort Historic Site. And then we have the historic Fort Macon, the North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores, or one of many walking or biking tours with Hungry Town Tours. Now, the spring Beaufort Wine and Food Experience celebrates its dynamic culinary scene with wine dinners and tastings, an Epicurean village, and more. Summer's Old Homes and Gardens Tour is also popular. Beaufort also offers charming inns and bed and breakfast in the historic district and along the waterfront. Traditional southern B&Bs and southern homes include the Inn on Turner and Pecan Tree Inn, with more modern waterfront accommodations that can be found at friendly Beaufort Inn. So lots of fun there along the Tar Heel Coast. Well, before our time ends, why don't we take a quick look at the Carolina Road Trip Planner from the March-April 2019 issue of AAA Go Magazine, see if there's something that might catch your fancy here. Coming up on April 27th, we have the Greater Cleveland Chamber Strawberry Festival Technology Drive in Garner, and that's just outside the capital city here. And festival will include tons of family fun and strawberries. It's all free. GreaterClevelandChamber.com gives you more information online. That's GreaterClevelandChamber.com. On April 27th, there's the Satchmo tribute to Louis Armstrong at the Carolina Civic Center, Lumberton, North Carolina. Dean Sims plays trumpet like the master himself and matches his singing style and on-stage persona. And there is a fee for this, but you can get more information at CarolinaCivicCenter.com, CarolinaCivicCenter.com. Also on April 27th, Mead Hall Strawberry Festival, Mead Hall's upper campus, Aiken, South Carolina. Games, bounce house, train ride, silent auction, entertainment, food, and plenty of strawberries. It's all free, and you can learn more at tbreadcountry.org, T-B-R-E-D, tbreadcountry.org. And then on the 27th, we have the Railroad Festival, downtown Central South Carolina, and the Marsh Walk of Merrill's Inlet at Dave's Dockside in Merrill's Inlet, South Carolina. And with that, we're going to have to say goodbye for another journey on today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it, and that you'll be back with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And the broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.